Hello, Kansas City. This is Every Woman, and I'm Christina Frazier, and I'm joined here with Una Nowling.
Hello.
And Fiona Nowling.
Hello.
And I want to say happy St. Patrick's Day to everybody out there. Fiona, do you have any Irish blood?
I've got some Irish second cousins and an Irish great uncle. And I suppose I've got third cousins and second cousins once removed and other complications like that.
My family name is actually Irish. Nowling used to be originally O'Nochlin. And then, So that's one of the reasons I have the name Una, because it's an Irish name that means truth.
Oh, cool.
But I'm actually wearing a green t-shirt, and it's too warm in the studio for me to have my orange Guinness jacket on.
Yeah, you're the only one wearing green today.
Okay, everyone sit still while I run around and pinch and punch everyone.
Well, I'm glad that you could join us today, everybody. I'm excited about our topic today, which is all about Osage women. And I think it's really interesting to go back in time or to look at other cultures and how women, gender roles and how women have come up through their culture. And I think it just kind of informs us a little bit better about what is going on with us today. And so we're going to be joined today by Tia Edwards. And Tia is a PhD, and she's the director of the Kansas Studies Institute and associate professor of history at Johnson County Community College. We'll be joined by Jesselyn Hudgens, and she is the director of the Osage Cultural Center in Pawhuska, Oklahoma. And then a little later in the hour, we will be joined by Stoney Osborne, and she's the board secretary at the Kansas City Indian Center in Kansas City, Missouri, which is right down the street from the studio. And so before we get started, I just wanted to kind of talk a little bit about, just kind of give a little bit of overview about the Osage tribe. When people in Kansas City think of the local Native American history, they may think of familiar place names like Shawnee, Shawnee Mission, Huron Cemetery, or Wyandotte County. Many of our place names remember the tribes that came to the Kansas City area because of the Indian Removal Act of 1830, a law signed by Andrew Jackson that resulted in many tribes that once lived in the East moving to the new, quote, Indian country in Kansas, which at the time included much of Kansas City. But before these tribes came to Kansas, other Native American groups were already here. In the area around Kansas City, this included Kansas namesake of the Kansas River, Kansas, and Kansas City. But there was another local tribe, the Osage, who lived in Kansas, Missouri, and Oklahoma, and Arkansas. And centuries before that, along the Ohio River further east. Like the Kansa and their cousins, the Omaha and Ponca, they spoke a Siouan language. The Osage River in Missouri is named after them, and it was in the center of their homeland at the time of white settlement. They lived generally south of the Missouri River. Today, the Osage tribe is located in Oklahoma near Pawhuska. Osage means children of the middle waters, and there's a recent best-selling book called Killers of the Flower Moon about the Osage murder and birth of the FBI. And it was about the murders of two wealthy Osage people, and I believe they're going to turn that into a movie. But right here in Kansas City, Johnson County Community College history professor Tia Edwards has a book, Osage Women, Gender and Power, and it's set to be published in April by the University Press of Kansas. So, Tia, are you on the line?
Yes, I'm here. It's actually Ty Edwards.
Oh, I'm sorry. Ty Edwards.
That's okay. It happens all the time.
I'm famous for messing up names. So how are you today?
Oh, I'm great. Thank you so much for having all of us on the show. I think this will be a great topic for your listeners.
Yeah, I was reading through your book, and definitely there were some really interesting things in there that I didn't know. And your book's very well written, too, because it was very easy for me to read. I kind of put it off a little bit, thinking it was going to be very academic, but it was really a very good story, I thought.
Well, thank you. One of the things that's nice about teaching at a community college is it teaches you the importance of writing approachable history.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I felt it was very approachable. So is this your first book?
Yes, it is. I've written some articles about the Osage experience with disease in Kansas, but this is the first book-length study.
Okay. And so you're a non-native, and so what when you write a book, as I know because my husband's an author, it is a huge devotion of time and effort, so you have to be really, really mm-hmm. interested in your topic. So how did you get interested in this topic?
Well, I think like most things, a good teacher was my gateway drug into this subject. So my bachelor's degree is actually in business, and when I was studying as an undergrad, I decided to take some history classes thinking they'd be quote-unquote fun, right? You know, I learned something. So I took a Plains Indians class with Rita Napier, who was a really important professor of Kansas and Native history at KU, and that class, really every day I had like this shocked look on my face, and she had a lot of Indigenous graduate students who did a lot of the teaching also in that class, and I just realized that everything I had learned up until that point had been absolutely inaccurate and offensively inaccurate. And as I joke to my students now, once you start to learn that one set of things you thought you knew was utterly wrong, you start to wonder what other sets of things that you think are true that are utterly wrong. And so later I went back to graduate school to study history more, and it was just a natural evolution through that to studying natives in Kansas, which is where I was born and where I'm from, and the native history of that region. And then I was reading a book once, a really great history book, that was talking about Osage power when they had their empire in Missouri and Oklahoma and Arkansas and Kansas. And it just said something, it had one line that said, it seems like Osage history was built on the success of men, and women's place probably became less significant than in the past. And just, I was suspicious that that wasn't the case. And from there, I just did the research to investigate that question.
And you found quite the opposite, correct?
Yes, basically, yes. I was suspicious that that wasn't correct, and the evidence bears it out.
Before we get into talking about your book a little bit more, in the title, let's see, it says gender roles. Can you? Mm-hmm. I'd like you to just break down what the difference between gender and sex, because in the world, you know, in the media and everything, people talking,
right.
People mix that up all the time, and it just mm-hmm. irritates me. So, could you just kind of break it down for us?
Yeah. So, gender is a construction, right? So, societies define gender and how many genders there are, and what behaviors are acceptable amongst these genders, and the power relations between them. So all societies do that. That's the construction of gender. And so those things differ amongst societies. So in Native North America, and the Osage are part of this, gender is constructed. There's certainly male and female, but there's also space between where other genders exist. And the power balance between Osage genders, and this is the case in many Native and Indigenous American cultures, was not one of gender hierarchy, which is the Western stereotype, right? In the Western stereotype, sort of the Euro-American history, you have male dominance, and then children and women are dependent, right, in that dominance. But that's not the case in most Native societies. So in the Osage construction, there's gender complementarity. So men and women and the other genders that they constructed had different sets of responsibilities, but they were equal in power and in social construction. And then sex exists totally separate from all of that, right? So sex is defined in all different kinds of ways. So if you look in the Osage construction, right, Americans often have a stereotype that marriage is tied to sex and monogamy is somehow related to these aspects of the construction of gender. But that's not the case in many societies, and that's not the case in Osage society. So sex wasn't necessarily tied to marriage. It wasn't tied to power relations. It's not constructed in that same way. So the way that they behave and the way they interact with one another is going to in many ways not be familiar to a lot of the Europeans and Americans they will eventually see, and will be constructed in a different sort of power dynamic.
So tell me a little bit about, so what you're saying is the actual sex, it was not connected with power. And so what was connected with power in the Osage Nation?
Yeah. Right. So for the way I say it in the book is In Osage culture, in terms of power, women were born with it and men had to earn it. So in the Osage construction of gender, women had power because they were creators of human life. Mm-hmm. And their ability to create human life was similar to spiritual forces that created all life. And that was something that after menses, women could do, right? The implication being you don't even technically need training, right? Women had to train, of course, for all of their economic and other kinds of work. But women were powerful inherently once they were adults. Whereas men, to achieve their goals, which is protecting and providing, you know, they have to train also for that work, and they have to strive and struggle in order to achieve those things. And so those are not one, male and female were not powerful over one another, they just achieved power in different ways. And so people didn't have power over one another in that sort of gendered way.
So the power was more about what you did and what you accomplished versus mm-hmm. just, what you achieved or what you provided for the group, I guess.
Yeah. So kind of it's a little more complicated than our stereotypes often seem, right? So in many cases, Native power was about individual action, individual spiritual relationships, and then relationship to the community, whereas this sort of disputes the idea of being dependent on or being subservient to in the Western construction. So, yeah, so a man that was great at his work was great at his work because he was connected to the community, he had his spiritual relationships in order, etc. And a woman, the same case.
I see. That's interesting. One of the things that I found also interesting about your book was that you said in the book that when the colonizers or the missionaries, mm-hmm. came across the Osage and they saw how their culture was, the women were independent. And the women did mm-hmm. Outdoor chores, and mm-hmm. And they were sexually free, and so they mm-hmm. felt like that was not what women that wasn't feminine or that wasn't what women were supposed to do. They were supposed to. Their idea of womanness was being frail and weak. And when I read that, the first thing that came to my mind was this that dichotomy that many of us women. Western women mm-hmm. understand, which is the difference between sort of the mother wife and sort of the whore prostitute.
Exactly.
And
yeah,
I thought
exactly.
That's really interesting. So can you talk about that?
Yeah. So because Osage women had independent power, you know, built into their gender and the understanding of men and women, there isn't this hierarchy of women based on almost the control of their sexuality, right, which you see in sort of the Euro-American or the Western construction. Women had control over their work. Women had control over their property. They had control over their bodies. And that informed, they had control over their fertility, too. This controlled how they interacted in the community. And so it's shocking, right, if you're a missionary to see women tilling fields, right, and women harvesting crops and women moving all of the domestic items and owning them. These were all things, and then as you're saying, being sexually free. All of these things were stemming from her independence, and all of them from a Western construction seemed to be sort of two sides of the same coin, right? Sexual freedom to a missionary at the time would have looked like, you know, the whore construction you were talking about. But then also doing all of that labor from a Western construction appeared to be almost like slavery. So if you see outsiders often characterize Native women as the quote-unquote squaw drudge, right? So squaw is the Native equivalent word of assigning whore status to a Native woman, and then drudge being as if she is the slave to her male relatives. And so it's kind of interesting that they framed all of this behavior as inferior, basically. But Native women were economically significant, and they had economic power, and they had respect because of all of that work. It was the outsider construction that work was not valuable. Natives didn't have that same hang-up. And her sexual freedom was part of individual autonomy that was embraced for all people. And you just see how both of those constructions, sexuality and work, are things that a woman had control of and was respected for. And in the European construction, you know, it's exactly the opposite.
Well, I'm going to stop
you.
I want to stop you right there. We need to take just a short break, and we're going to come back, and we're going to talk more about this because this is very interesting.
Is it possible to build a positive future amid the degradations and violence in prison? Jaws of Justice Radio talks with Ricky Kidd and Frank Polina about how they are charting a path to a good life while in Jackson County Jail. Jaws of Justice Radio, 9 a.m. Monday, right after Democracy Now!
What's that sound, you ask? It's the sound of one-time-use trash. People get bottled water because of hydration, convenience, and the claim of better taste and quality. Truth is, there's usually no difference between bottled and tap water. The healthier choice is to get a cool, reusable bottle made of lined aluminum, steel, glass, or special plastic that won't break off chemical bits like the plastic used in disposable bottles. Get healthy and keep your world from becoming a big junk pile. Disposables dead. Brought to you by J.C. Herman High School and 90.1 FM KKFI.
Hi, everybody. We're back, and this is Every Woman, and I'm here with Ty Edwards, who has just written a book about Osage women, and Jesselyn Hudgens couldn't join us today, so we have Stoney Osborne on the phone, and we're going to talk to her in just a few minutes, but Fiona, you had a question.
Yes, you'd said about them tilling the lands, and so much the story of the immigrants, the settlers that came in, is that the Indians were savages and they were nomads and they didn't till the lands or own any of the property.
Right.
And that's why they took it away from them. But that totally breaks that story down.
Correct. Yeah, so the Osage, like many Native communities, were farmers, and Osage women were farmers. They controlled all of the farming. They did all the labor. They owned all of the farm goods that they farmed. So after harvest, it was their property. And of course, those are that's not just valuable food for the community. That's a valuable trade good, right, with outsiders. But from the Osage spiritual view, the reason why women were farmers is because planting seeds in the earth and growing them to maturity where they become edible food is the exact same spiritual skill set as growing human life and giving birth. So it was believed that men just did not have that spiritual skill set. So they couldn't do that work.
That's really neat. I could see an argument for the men doing the sowing of the seed and then the women doing all the tending and the raising of the crop, though.
To sum it up, we usually say that men were in the business of taking life and women were in the business of giving life.
And so the Osage religion plays into this a lot. It kind of sets the tone for the equality because it seems like it's very yin and yang. Can you explain the religion a little bit?
Yeah, so from the Osage perspective, all of their behavior, even down to the construction, how they constructed their homes, et cetera, was all based on their spiritual view of the world. In Native societies, there's typically in Native languages no word for religion because religion wasn't separate from life. Religion, or what would be more accurately, spirituality, defined everything. So there was spiritual power in everything, and it was the job of people to properly use it, be properly grateful for it, and learn how to harness it effectively. And so the Osage spiritual view of the world was based on how they viewed the natural world operating. And they viewed the natural world as operating in often a duality or at least circular-based construction. So sun and moon, if you will, day and night, if you will, these kinds of constructions. And then, of course, the seasons of the year, right, the growth cycle of plants. All of these things were circle and, from the Osage perspective, dual. And so that's part of one of the things I wanted to study in the book is the perception that from the Osage perspective, they needed men and women together. Everything had to be together to mirror the natural world, the spiritual forces in the world, and that's how you had success. So when the Osage are very successful after colonization, after the French colonization begins in building what's called an indigenous empire, the stereotype of many historians has been that must have been on the on the prowess of men, because men hunted and that was the goods that were traded. And so that empire must have been built by men, and so women must have been declining in status. But if you look at it from the Osage perspective, the world is dual. And so I was suspicious that the Osage couldn't imagine a world where they were successful unless men and women were successful together. And that's what the evidence bears out.
And part of that, an example of this in your book was how, because I was a little confused about separate work, but yet equally important.
Right.
And I think it's just because of the culture I come from, because we're still trying to gain equality. But I think mm-hmm. a really good example of that was that, like, for instance, the hides. So the
right.
the men would hunt, and then they would, mm-hmm. you know, kill the animal. But without the women, you know, tanning the hide and making the hide saleable or tradable, the hide
right.
didn't have any value. So it
right.
required
yeah.
both people, the men and the women, to create, you know, the goods. And I mm-hmm. thought that was a really good example of they had separate roles, but yet, you know, they were equally important.
Exactly. Yeah. So there are some scholars that argue that in our American history, we, for good reason, believe that segregation is wrong, right? Because of our history with racial hierarchy and Jim Crow. But if you look in other societies, separation and segregated work doesn't necessarily imply hierarchy. And so we have to be careful that our own history doesn't make us see separate as inherently unequal when other cultures define separate work as equally valuable, which is the case here.
I think a lot of it's the attitude of the people. Like, if mm-hmm. in modern times, if some guy goes out fishing and has a really nice day sitting on the water drinking beer and then comes home with 10 fish and throws them at his wife and says, clean these, then that's definitely not equal. That is drudgery.
Right. Right, but that's the construction, yeah, that they're existing in. I've actually been in quite a few discussions with scholars who study women in other cultures and in other times, and they often point out that many times women in other cultures, and you can look at this with even, you know, European immigrants to Kansas later who resettle after natives have been sort of expelled, that women are doing a lot of these same jobs, right, in a Western farm family. The trouble is the work is not valued, and that's the construction that's different.
And I don't see how they would think working on a farm, laboring from sunup to sundown, would be drudgery, and laboring in the house doing cleaning and cooking and things that need to be done over and over and raising the kids isn't drudgery, especially if it's not valued because it's women's
right.
work.
Right.
There's
right. These
hypocrisy.
Are all constructions of what's valuable.
Yeah.
Right.
Real hypocrisy and blindness there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, and if a man in American culture is noble for farming, right? Why isn't a woman in a native culture noble for farming?
Yeah, I was also really interested in, you know, when you put it in your book about how the colonizers or the Western idea of women being weak and frail.
Mm-hmm.
I felt like, and then in the Osage construction, it's, you know, women being sort of you know, I mean, capable, I guess we could say.
Right. Powerful.
What yeah. is, did you ever think what that says about the men in both cultures?
Yeah, well, so this is exactly a good point, and this is also useful in teaching. So if the hierarchy is constructed, as it was in American culture, that men are independent and dominant, right? So they are dominant over women and dominant over children, and in some cases dominant over other men, right, who are lower in the hierarchy. And if you look at it that way, then that masculinity is arguably constructed in a very fragile way because it's only that control that defines it. But from an Osage perspective, their genders were constructed separately and equally, and all work is valuable. So those men can be valued for their work, their generosity, their relationships, their benefits to the community, and it has nothing to do with their control over wives, children, or others. And you could argue that creates a masculinity that is more complexly defined and thus less fragile, which is why I was suspicious that if the Osage built a powerful empire and they had this construction, it seems very likely that they would have constructed it with men and women in order to make it work from their perspective, and that is what happened.
Hmm. Well, I want to bring in Stoney, who's on line two. Hi, Stoney.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Yeah, and so I wanted to, I know you've been listening to the conversation a little bit. I wanted to get your perspective on the topic and just women, Indigenous women's lives today as compared to what we're talking about from the past.
Well, I think that women's lives today, I mean, it's so complex on so many different levels, but I feel that women are still searching for their roles in the society, and I can only speak, like, for my tribe and similar Choctaw tribes, similar to the Osage. Women were held in a great respect, and being the givers of life, it's definitely a lot different than you see mainstream society and how it is now.
So has some of this are women in your tribe, are they still respected? I mean, do they have more respect for their work and for their role in the community than maybe a Western woman?
You know, I think so. Along with colonization, though, you know, each tribe mm-hmm. has taken that on differently. I know that many women are fighting to keep the traditions alive. There is a lot of pride in the traditions, in the, you know, the harvesting of the land and, you know, through, like, the weaving and through our beadwork. I mean, it may seem, you know, so small to Western society, but a lot of pride is taking in it, and women in the tribe are working to keep the traditions alive, yes.
Mm-hmm.
One thing that struck me, and I was wondering if this had changed at all between the Osage women of the past versus the Osage women of the present, is my understanding mm-hmm. is the Osage religious practices are very male-dominated and predominantly were led by men, and as they call them, the little old men is what I saw. Is this something mm-hmm. that has evolved at all or changed over time?
And are you asking Ty?
I'm asking anyone, I guess.
Well, Stoney, do you want to take that? I can speak to it as well.
Well, I'll go ahead and then I'll let Ty speak on it.
Let me just say, Stoney, could you speak a little bit closer to your...
Yes.
You're a little soft. We can't quite hear you.
Is this better?
Yes. Yes, thank you.
Okay. You know, I will say with colonization, like with my tribe in particular... our tribe, you know, adopted Christianity, you know, took on those beliefs. And so that's not our traditional ways. I think that, you know, up until the Religious Act, we weren't allowed to practice our traditional ways. And so I feel mm-hmm. like a lot of that has been lost, but I feel like it is coming back.
Yeah, I would like to piggyback on what Stoney said. So the thing that goes between what Stoney's talking about and the older history I was talking about is the brutality of European and American colonization. The entire effort was to eliminate natives, either literally or culturally.
I'm sorry, Ty, you're breaking up a little bit.
Yes. Can you hear me now?
Yeah, that's better.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Okay. So the entire point of American colonization was to eliminate Native people, either literally or culturally. And this was done with missionization, this was done with violence, this was done with all kinds of policies, impoverishment, etc. And so all of that assaulted every single aspect of Native life, from, in the Osage case, trying to force men to do farming and stop women from doing it, trying to assault religion, trying to separate children from their parents to indoctrinate them in American culture. The brutality of that is severe, and one of the things I do talk about later in the book is the literal genocidal population loss that comes from this. One of the ways you accomplish this is by making sure that literally fewer Osage people exist, and then it will be more difficult for them to maintain their identity and their history. So in the context of that brutality, how do people exist and maintain their identity and their lives in a world that changes vastly around them in almost every sense? So that brutality intends to eliminate, and in many ways the cost is going to be horribly traumatic. So for the Osage to maintain aspects of their culture and religion to the present, is nothing short of miraculous and heroic, and speaks to their effort to do so. Referring to your question about the little old men, one of the things I do point out in the book is some of the original translations into English call their original sort of history as something that comes from the seers, who are not gendered in their reference. And one of the things I talk about is it depends on how you view their spiritual leaders, but women played a pretty significant role in their spiritual practices. And men could not even be spiritual leaders unless they were married, because you needed that dual male-female place. But when a husband died, a woman could take over his spiritual role in a lot of their spiritually elite practices and in keeping their traditions alive. So I think the construction of priesthood sometimes has a lot of Western baggage that isn't entirely applicable to their history, even though the English translation is often translated as little old men. And many men were part of this priesthood, but many women played significant roles in it as well.
I can see where studying, you know, people's, I mean, the Osage are still with us, but I mean, we're talking about
right.
the Osage from the past. I can see how that really enlightens you or somebody who's reading the book, because, I mean, several times during our conversation, we've pointed out constructions that we have that we maybe aren't even aware of. And
right.
I think I can see the value in sort of looking at somebody else's perspective of what's important in the world, and then it kind of challenges, you know, what we think or what we believe. So that's really interesting.
Right.
But I do want to talk to Stoney for a minute. I want to go off topic just a little bit. Stoney, I want to ask you again, now, what is your tribe?
Choctaw.
Choctaw, okay. And you, you're with the Kansas City Indian Center. And what does the Indian Center do?
Yes. You know, our biggest mission at the Indian Center is just to encourage social, educational, and economic advancement for American Indian communities in Kansas City. We, you know, promote traditional and cultural values, and we are there just to keep it alive and to pass it on. We do cultural services, and we just look to have a place to where natives in the community have a place to come to and be together, you know, because before the center was actually there, people would just host their house. It would be one native and would open their home for any other, you know, natives who wanted to come in and just be together. And so the center really is there. I mean, 39th and Pennsylvania, you're pretty well in, you know, right there in the city, is just there for anybody in the community. Yeah, so.
And about how many Native people live in the metro area?
You know, I'm sorry, I can't give you just a definite answer on that, but I mean, there's over 500 federally recognized tribes, and so, you know, there's so many different tribes and so many different people. I'm sorry, I can't give you a definite.
Oh, no, that's okay. What are some of the
well,
most...
I think,
Can I interject real quick?
I think my colleagues at the Center for American Indian Studies at JCCC say that there's about, in the tens of thousands of Native people that live in the metro area. So it's a much more sizable population than people think.
Mm-hmm. Well, I live in Lawrence, so, you know, we have Haskell in Lawrence. So... In Lawrence, you know, Native American culture and people are just a lot more abundant, you know, in our daily lives. So, What I just wanted to ask Stoney, so what are some women's issues that you see that Native American women have in Kansas City? I mean, are there any issues that are a little bit different than just women's issues in general?
You know, I wouldn't say that they're any different. I feel like here it's not as bad as compared to indigenous women, you know, up north. You know, there's a lot of missing, murdered, and indigenous women. I think that a lot of people, a lot of women are just really trying to find their way, you know. A lot of traditions weren't passed on, and that's either from, you know, maybe they were shamed or, you know, their family just didn't pass it. I met a woman, and she thought she was Mexican and had no idea that she was indigenous. And so now, you know, there's a lot of people that are just looking to learn about their ways and looking to pass that on. And so I think that the issues aren't much different than from, you know, other women in the city. I think that it's a little bit harder to maybe connect, feel connected than other, you know, maybe than other races in the city. But I wouldn't say they're too different.
So, Ty, excuse me. So, Ty, so some of this disconnection is because of colonization, right? I mean, it was.
I would argue all of it is okay. Because of colonization.
Mm-hmm. And so.
Yeah, I mean, that was the intent, right? Was to assault communities. So.
Mm-hmm. And so having. I mean, I think what's very interesting is the way it's presented in our Western society is that we don't have any examples of women and men being equal, and and there's all this sort of fuss about, well, you know, if women are equal, or if women go to work, or if women start to do male roles, then the whole society is going to fall apart and everything's going to be chaos. Right. And so I think, you know, it's really great to know that there were cultures and cultures here that had that equality and they, you know, they were thriving.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I absolutely agree. I mean, I think the question I was trying to ask is how does one bear colonization, right? Like how does it attempt to destruct, and how does a person or community attempt to resist or survive? And one of the things that I think is a site of resisting colonization is gender. And I think so in the Osage example, women still play very prominent roles in leadership and saving history and in their ceremonial celebrations and in scholarship and serving as scholars for the community. And I would argue Stoney's doing the same thing in her community. Women as powerful isn't always something that falls into the construction that maybe Euro-American women are looking for, but from a Native construction is very historically tied. If we're looking for role models, I think you don't have to look that far, is what you're pointing out, right? Stoney's right there in Kansas City. This is the kind of work that indigenous women have been doing and continue to do. And they can be role models to us in that work.
So, Stoney, you were talking, you kind of said just a brief bit about the beadwork and how some people might not think that that's important, but that is a significant, it is significant. Can you explain a little bit more about what you meant?
You know, just like you were speaking about the, you know, the European, you know, perspective on it all. I know that the traditional ways are hard to understand. I know that they seem, you know, maybe simple and you know, just maybe look down upon. You know, I'm sorry, like women, for example, like even, I mean, I just kind of goes back to the past, but, you know, even like just speaking on the Choctaw tribe, you know, it was hard for the Europeans to understand, like, why a man would bring a woman to a diplomatic, you know, mission or a meeting. And you know, the Europeans thought that that was a mark of being, you know, like more of a savage. Why would they bring these women here? But really, the men brought the women because the women are so important in the tribe. When it comes to, like, the beadwork and the weaving, it wasn't just weaving baskets, for example. You know, that the weaving technique, that was also to make the homes. And in the beadwork, there's prayers put into the beadwork. And so even though it is something so simple, we, you know, when we get together and when we do those things, there's store, you know, our oral traditions are being passed on. There's prayers that are being said. There's a people be, you're connecting, you know, through something even so simple as that.
So, Ty, tell me, you seem to have a particular interest in colonization and genocide. Is that correct?
Yes.
And can you tell me a little bit about why that is?
Well, I consider myself a colonial historian. I'm interested in the mechanisms of how colonialism works and how it's perpetrated and justified. And the closest geographically place to look at how colonialism works is in terms of European and American colonization of indigenous people, which in many ways continues to the present. So once you start learning about colonization, in my view, the whole modern world starts to make much more sense. So when I'm teaching to my students, colonization, you know, is the bedrock of certainly United States history and the Americas in general from, you know, basically the 1500s to the present. But you can't even understand, I would argue, the civil war in Syria or the quote-unquote war on terror if you don't understand colonialism. I mean, these are the things that unify a lot of this history. And when you start to orient yourself around learning it, you start to see these themes that come out all across the world. And there's different kinds of colonialism, of course. So American colonialism, the United States, and this was inherited from the British colonial model, was what we call settler colonialism. So you have people that desire land, in this case, who want that land to improve their status. The problem is, of course, there are indigenous people on that land. So how do you take something that clearly belongs to someone else, is being used by someone else, and acquisition it for yourself? And that's how colonialism works. So settler colonialism, in many ways, is rooted in the hierarchy of European and later American society, where people want to improve their status. And in order to do so, one person's freedom came at another's expense, and that was indigenous people. Colonialism, of course, defines slavery for African Americans and North America, and once you start to see this, it just shows you how colonialism functions. So one of the things we talk about is settler colonizers need natives to be out of the way. And there's lots of ways for natives to get out of the way. So you mentioned the Indian Removal Act when you started this program. Well, Indian removal is ethnic cleansing. It's purging natives from an area where they live as an ethnic group to make way for another ethnic group, which is primarily American citizens of European descent. And removal just concentrated native people in, you know, smaller and smaller confines. And when that doesn't work, you know, violence is also an option. And this can be genocide in many different methods of violence. And a lot of people, including an Osage scholar, George Tinker, have argued that missionization is cultural genocide. It is attempting to literally eliminate native culture. So that's another way of eliminating native people, because their identity will be erased. So these are the ways that colonialism functions, and that's why I was curious, how can this be withstood? How is this resisted? And what's the toll of it? And the toll, of course, is brutal.
Yeah, in your book you were saying that the justification of the land settlements was that the, quote, savage native lifestyle was unsustainable, as opposed to the yeoman farmer, which was considered to be the sustainable, you know, way of
living
on the land. And they were saying that they're saving the, quote, natives from extinction. But I thought that was interesting, because from an environmental perspective, that's exactly the opposite. I mean, that, you know, the way that the land... I'm not idealizing right. you know, the native cultures as far as like farming and stuff. But we know that, you know, working more closely with the land and the seasons as opposed to mm-hmm. row farming with you know, transportation and chemicals right. and stuff like that, that's right. that's not sustainable. So
taking it back to gender, the argument I make is the biggest difference between native resource use and Euro-American resource use is population. And native women had control over their fertility. So in Osage society, women had on average 3 to 4 kids, and they were usually 3-ish years apart because Osage women, when they were lactating, did not have sexual intercourse because of what they believed about the spiritual power of those bodily fluids. And so their children were spaced out. Mortality for mothers was much lower, and those children were able to survive to adulthood much more effectively. And at the exact same time the Osage are having about that many children on average, American women are having on average 8 children. So that's double the number of children. And of course, as we know, for many American women, childbirth was deadly. And many children died in childhood because of all kinds of issues that come from this. So when you get right back to it, again, women having control over self and control over body and fertility changes the number of children that they have, and that changes their environmental use and how they can sustain their community.
Mm-hmm. So, Stoney, as far as Native women, contemporary Native women, you know, there's a lot of things going on with, you know, the Black Lives Matter and the Me Too movement and the Women's March. Are Native people also feeling a sense of empowerment and strength during these times?
You know, I really do think so. You know, our ancestors predicted that all of this would happen. And so it's hard not to remember, you know, everything that our ancestors stood for and to know that they knew that this was the way it was going to go and that everything is meant to be the way it is and that it does, you know, come full circle. You know, I think Standing Rock was a huge mm-hmm. movement for Indigenous people. I think that it's really brought a lot of tribes together that hadn't necessarily worked together, you know, since colonization, hadn't necessarily worked together since the tribes had been recognized. And I think that it's been a ripple effect. And I do believe that all Indigenous people are, you know, rising and that... I think that overall, you know, it's the human race, you know. It's not just for one race to figure this out and to make it, you know, better. We're all human race. And so, you know, I do feel that, you know, it's positive.
So you said that your ancestors predicted this. What do you mean by that?
Just the rising, like our Seven Council Fire and our youth right now. Our youth has really stepped up and really, you know, the Standing Rock, that is a youth-led movement. And so that's kind of what I mean by that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm always surprised. I'm surprised at how I think most Americans, most people understand that the tribes had a lot of things stolen from them and taken from them, and you know, and they understand about some of the cultural genocide and things like that. And then I'm always surprised how the same thing keeps happening today, and it's not even they're trying to take rights away, you know, so tribes don't have control over their lands. And those weren't even the lands that they wanted to have in the first place. They were kicked off the land that they originally were on, and then they have some other land, and then, you know, they're trying to come up with tricks and ways to take their control off that land. And it makes me angry. I'm not a Native American person, but it just upsets me that it's just so blatant. And I don't understand why some people in power still feel like they can just walk right over Native people.
And I think that Fiona has a news article, actually, about some recent activity along those lines.
Yes, there have been more and more news articles recently. They first started making mutterings about doing this back at the end of 2016, where it said that Trump's advisors aimed to privatize oil-rich Indian reservations. And it pointed out that although the Native American reservations cover just 2% of the United States, it's possible that they contain about a fifth of the nation's oil and gas and also vast coal reserves. And we all know that Trump really, really loves coal for some reason. And obviously, they made a big mistake in giving people land that they thought was useless and not realizing that it was useful and they'd want to steal it again and take it back again later. They're talking about privatizing the lands and selling them off, claiming that the tribes are suffering under suffocating federal bureaucracy. And obviously they're doing it for their own good, taking the land away from them and selling it to someone else and meaning they can't live there or govern it the way that they want to. It's totally for their own good because then there's less bureaucracy involved. And the fact that they and their cronies will make millions from the resources that belong to the indigenous people is obviously immaterial in that equation.
So, Ty, is this colonialism all over? Is this, what is this?
Yes, it's textbook. Yeah, so whenever you imply that people are not qualified to manage their own resources and you can do it better, you are implying that they are lower than you in the hierarchy and somehow, quote-unquote, savage, right? We are going to teach them, quote-unquote, how to use their resources. Another theme of American history is after all economic collapses, especially in the 1800s, when the Americans needed economic stimulus, native resources were often viewed as the way to stimulate the American economy. And so native people had to be moved out of the way, literally, in many cases, for those resources to benefit Americans and their economy. I mean, I would argue that the entirety of the of U.S. economic development has been rooted, especially from the founding, in developing colonized resources. And so this is just a theme that continues. Native people don't have control. Native people are not asked what they want or how they would like their resources used. Policymakers know what's best, quote-unquote, for these children of the government, wards of the government, as those old constructions were built.
And so what you, toward the end of your book, there was something about that you were saying about the importance of recovering the feminine. Can you talk to me about what that means?
Yeah. So a woman, Paula Gunn Allen, wrote a book, I think several decades ago now at this point, and she's Native, and she was arguing that scholars in particular needed to start recovering the feminine in their stories of Native people and in their scholarship on Native people. And I would argue with the Osages is particularly important because in the history of powerful nations, of war, of politics, those things in many ways are still constructed as the history of men. Even though in indigenous societies in particular, as Stoney was pointing out, that wasn't accurate. And by recovering the role of women in what they were actually doing and the ways they were contributing to all of these things and participating and making decisions in all of these things, a different world will open to you. And so that's what I was trying to do, is especially in the context of the Osage Empire and the colonization they experienced, what was the role of women? It's not that they didn't do things, it's that we hadn't paid attention, scholars had not paid attention to the things that they did. I will point out, though, that the Osage are very prolific and have been for decades in writing their own scholarship that's published and easily accessible. And they did not have that blindness to the role of women. It's non-Native scholars that had that blindness to the role of women.
I see. So, again, it's another sort of informational colonization, I guess, by just sort of eliminating huge part of the, you know, of history. And then you believe that that's the truth, but it's only part of the truth.
Right. Yeah, unfortunately, scholarship and academia has played a large role in colonizing Natives in the past and the present as well.
And they do it in all sorts of fields, like in history of science in Western civilization. Who discovered the structure of DNA? It's not just right. Watson and Crick. There were four people, and a really key person was a woman. And she got left out and left out of the story, and then she died. Rosalind Elsie Franklin died before the award was made of the Nobel Prize for Chemistry. And she's just totally erased from the story, and her importance was only recently rediscovered.
Mm-hmm.
So, Stoney, I wanted to ask you, we have a few minutes left. So how can people support the center?
There are many opportunities to volunteer in person. If you're not able to volunteer in person, of course, somebody could always visit our website. We do take donations, but one of our big events of the year is our culture camp that we provide for our youth, and it's not just for Indigenous children, it's for, you know, all children if they would like to learn more traditional ways and learn about the culture. And so we are a nonprofit, and so all the services that we're able to do is done through donations. We do have a fundraiser coming up, and people are always, any people is more than welcome to come. We have a culture night the first Wednesday of every month. Anybody's welcome in the community. It's potluck. And even just to come in and just have dinner and visit and talk, that's support. It's all about community, you know. And so many different ways you can support in person, monetary, you know, however one would like. There's many opportunities for
it. Stoney, can you give us the web address really quickly? Because you said they can find the information
yes.
in there.
It's kcindiancenter.org. And we also have a Facebook page, Heart of America, Kansas City Indian Center.
Thank you.
And with that, we have run out of time, but I just want to really thank Tia Edwards, and her book is, I got to get the title, it's Osage Women.
Gender and Power.
Yeah, and it's by the University Press of Kansas, and that's going to be coming out in April. And then we had Stoney Osborne, and she's the board secretary at the Kansas City Indian Center, and it's just right down the street here in Kansas City, Missouri. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.